I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order. Good morning, everyone. We have a really full agenda, and so we may have to carry over till this afternoon if we could have a quorum, or if we have members that can attend. So I just want you to realize that these are extremely important bills that we are considering, and with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 456, and would you bring us up to date, Mr. Shook?
Madam Chair, there were seven Senate bills recommended by the Oregon Health Fund Board, and we've heard five of them. We'll hear the other two this morning. We'll start with 456, which establishes the Oregon Integrated Health Home Program and requires the Department of Human Services to provide reimbursement for integrated home health services, creates a statewide health improvement program to develop goals for reduction of chronic disease factors, and requires DHS to collaborate with health insurers and purchasers of health plans for publicly funded health plan enrollees receiving care consistent with health improvement program.
Okay, and just to let you know, there are 14 people signed up. That's 14 people into 60 minutes is basically 4 minutes apiece. So just to give you sort of a perspective of all this, because I know some of you are going to take more time than others. With that, I'd like to call Dr. Janine Smith, Dr. Rick Wolpack, and Laura Brennan.
Good morning, Chair Marta Sanderson and members of the committee. Thanks for inviting us. I am Janine Smith, Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, and talking about Senate Bill 456, which supports key activities and initiatives recommended by the Oregon Health Fund Board, which my office staffed. The board and its delivery committee spent a great deal of time focusing on Oregon's current delivery system, which is not equipped to meet the long-term prevention and primary care health needs of the population. Care is fragmented, and many Oregonians do not have regular and convenient care access to providers who can coordinate their care. In general, the current system rewards the treatment of acute problems rather than focusing on keeping people healthy, preventing disease, and efficiently managing health conditions once they are diagnosed. So the board and the delivery committee recommended opportunities to revitalize primary care and support community-driven efforts to prevent chronic disease and improve population health. Research demonstrates better health outcomes, higher patient satisfaction, and lower cost per capita in countries with strong prevention and primary care systems. This bill has basically two pieces. One is the development of some integrated health home program standards, getting commonly agreed upon standards in which we could capture what integrated health home, what kind of outcomes we would like to accomplish, and then use those standards to be able to set up payment reform systems, both either on the public side, such as in Medicaid, or hopefully, ideally, also on the commercial side. Programs such as the Public Employees Benefit Board, which I also sit on, has wanted to have every Oregonian employee that we cover to have an integrated health home or medical home. And this is a way to kind of get some common standards. So the ultimate goal is to get Oregonians the right care at the right time and in the right place. The second half of the bill is about trying to get all of us, within public entities, coordinated across some common quality standards and public health or population health standards. And then there's some dollars inside this bill that would direct it to the communities so that you would have a healthy home inside of a healthy community. The idea of an integrated health home derives originally from the American Academy of Pediatrics back in the 1960s. It's evolved. You may have heard the word medical home, patient-centered, primary care home. They're all the same basic terminology and coordinated of primary care coordination with to and from the hospital, to and from home. The idea is that the delivery system landed on the term integrated health home because they felt that they wanted to get away from some of the other definitions that are somewhat more physician-centric and realizing that there's other settings. What we often talked about in the delivery committee was that a chronic schizophrenic may actually have a stronger relationship with a mental health clinic, and the mental health clinic, as is some pilots going on in Benton County, could have physical health sort of consultation to make sure that the physical health needs are met while the mental health needs are met. So, and vice versa, I work part-time occasionally when I have spare time in a primary care renewal site of Care Oregon's Richmond Clinic, part of OHSU, and we have, just last Friday, I was able to step out of the room, pull in a behavioralist to talk to my patient who was struggling with some addiction issues and some depression issues, and let them make a connection, and I could move on to the next patient, and they could get their needs met, while I went on to deal with some more of the physical needs of the next patient. So what you have this morning is a lineup of quite a few people to talk about the medical home in more detail. Dr. Wopat, to my right, was on the delivery committee, and we'll add some comments. And Laura Brennan is going to talk a little bit more about the importance of the community connection in terms of coordinating this care. So the sort of practicalness of the bill is that our office, the Office of Health Policy, would establish through a collaborative process a definition of integrated health home using national work that's been done, and there are multiple entities looking at this and some common agreement across several groups.
Yeah,
we would work with both public and private stakeholders to come up with this common definition and a standardized set of quality measurements that could be used to measure the performance of the integrated health home. They would also establish a collaborative amidst the state agencies and the health homes to share information about best practices. This is an integral key. You can't just ask these clinics to just go forth and do this. It's really been a valuable portion of many of the medical home pilots across the country and in Oregon to share best practices. How do you make it work in the front office, the back office, and with the patients to understand this change of practice and how it's done? And then this common set of metrics could be used by the Medicaid agency to restructure how they pay for primary care. It doesn't mean that every single physician in every single office in Oregon will have this tomorrow. There's a transition phase. There's some that are early adopters, some that have been doing this on small pilots that would be really ready to go forward and would sustain those efforts. Solo small docs offices may not be quite ready for that, and we need to look at how we can help support them and perhaps on a more virtual basis be able to provide similar services to their patients. But it's not an expectation that every single physician tomorrow would be in an integrated health home. This is starting down the road towards that, but it's just the first steps. And then the DMAP and PEB and OEB could all work together to collectively be doing this across the board so that all public purchasing is directed towards this end. And then the statewide health improvement project, we've started a little bit of this by, we have the Health Policy Commission right now has been convening a group of leaders from the various public health, PEB and OEB, and DMAP, as well as our office and the Patient Safety Commission, to talk about some common agree upon quality standards we could all try to work in all of our programs so we're not working in silos. And what this bill does is to try to direct some dollars to incent more communities to be able to do that in companionship with the integrated health home restructure. There are several amendments that had been submitted to this bill, which I understand are not before you at this point, but I think we have a hand engrossed versions. Basically, most of these came from the Health Fund Board's Health Equities Committee, since our language was written many months ago and we were just trying to clean it up. But it basically ensures that the integrated health home will provide culturally and linguistically appropriate services, create opportunities for the integrated health homes to take advantage of important services provided by community health workers and medical interpreters, and that these changes ensure that the community collaborative is funded to implement chronic disease programs that identify the disparities and try to rectify that. And lastly, in an effort to control the fiscal attached to this bill, the proposed amendments clarify that DMAP will reimburse certified integrated health homes as the budget allows. We had originally hoped to have a larger pot of dollars associated with this bill, but those did not make it into the governor's recommended budget because of the economic times. We can always be hopeful that more dollars will become available, so hence the last amendment. So on that note, I will turn it over, since I am supposed to only take 4 minutes, to Dr. Wopat, who will, of course, only take 4 minutes.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. For the record, I'm Rick Wopat. I'm a family physician. I've practiced in Lebanon, Oregon for the last 30 years. I am currently a member of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, and in the past I've been a member of the Medicaid Advisory Committee and the Health Services Commission, where I had the pleasure of serving with Senator Bates for many years. So, for the last 20 years, I've been involved in health policy and consistently supported universal access to affordable, high-quality health care. In the last several years, I've come to the conclusion in many of the meetings that I've been, and I've heard persistently, that the issue is not just about universal access and coverage. If we give universal access and coverage to everyone in this country and we continue to care for people the way we're caring for them now, we will not solve the problems of high costs and quality and safety that we're all faced with. The key to building a world-class health care that's envisioned in the Health Fund Board report, in my mind, is moving from the current budget cycle mentality of our current insurance model that focuses on acute care to a life cycle mentality that focuses more on a public health model of and helps us to look at coordinated primary care and mental health care. It's my belief that such a long-term approach is best coordinated through the integrated health home that is proposed in this bill. And I'll say that I strongly support the intent of Senate Bill 456 to create the environment in this state that allows integrated health homes to develop and flourish. It's also my belief that the concept of the integrated health home should not be limited to Medicaid and the uninsured, but should be a concept upon which we build a health system, the world-class health system in Oregon for all Oregonians. And so I would encourage you not to look at this as a narrow approach, but really a broad-based approach for health care reform in general. My next point would be that I believe the state really holds the key to this problem and to creating the environment. In Lebanon, where I practiced in 2007 and 2008, over 80% of the births were funded by Oregon Health Plan. That means a large percentage of our hospital revenues, a large percentage of the children we take care of are funded through state tax dollars. And the key to changing the system is really changing the incentives and the rewards within the system, and the state has that key through the funding of Oregon Health Plan and funding of other state-supported health care. Lastly, I don't believe that we can wait to do this. I'm somewhat concerned about the amended language to change shall to may and to talk about when funding is available. I really believe that the funds in healthcare are available now. The question is not adding more money to how we care for health. The question is changing how we arrange the delivery system and how we have the incentives and rewards built within the delivery system. If we wait for funds to be available, my fear is we'll never make the leap and that this legislature can make this happen. The main barriers, I think, to this bill are two. One is fear and the other is money. The fear of change and the concern that there will be financial winners and losers if we make the change. I don't share that fear of change, and I think if we can do this right, we'll all be winners. My real fear is that we won't make the change and we'll end up all being losers. So again, I strongly support the concept. I have speakers who will follow who will talk about the science that this is based on and why this makes great sense. So with that, I'll turn it over. Thank you very much.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Laura Brennan, and I work for Pacific Source Health Plans, an Oregon-based not-for-profit health insurer that has been in business since 1933. Thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm the Community Development and Policy Director for Pacific Source, as well as the Executive Director of the Pacific Source Charitable Foundation. In each of these roles, I am allowed to and have the privilege to support community health efforts throughout Oregon and help Pacific Source pursue its vision of helping people get the health care they need. And I get to do this regardless of insurance status. I also have the pleasure of working with community health improvement efforts around the United States as a board member of Communities Joined in Action, a national nonprofit that provides technical assistance and support to hundreds of communities around the nation in their effort to assure better health for all people at less cost. I'm here to testify in support of SB 456. I specifically want to shine light on the statewide health improvement program as outlined in the bill and commend the Oregon Health Fund Board for recommending the creation of this program. The Statewide Health Improvement Program, or SHIP, will support evidence-based community efforts that prevent chronic disease and reduce the utilization of expensive and invasive medical treatments. While the integrated health home model is really important, very, very important for us to support that, and it's key to an effective delivery system, it's not a silver bullet. Integrated health homes are strongest when supported by a broader community-wide effort that refocuses local delivery systems on prevention and population health outcomes. Much of that work is within clinic walls, and much of that work was outside of clinic walls. As you know, unhealthy diet and physical inactivity can contribute to and aggravate chronic diseases and conditions like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, heart disease. During the past 20 years, obesity rates among adults have risen significantly. In 2006, 34% of adults in the United States were obese. In order to effectively address chronic diseases and their related risk factors, it's imperative to support integrated health homes and community health initiatives focused on improved health outcomes. Accordingly, SB 456 establishes SHIP within the Department of Human Services. As part of the program, DHS will establish aggressive goals for the reduction of chronic disease risk factors such as obesity. In addition, DHS will provide grants to health collaboratives that implement evidence-based prevention initiatives that complement the aims and work with the integrated health homes, focusing on reducing health disparities and improving the health status of every member of the community. Community health collaboratives such as 100% Access Coalition in Lane County and Health Matters of Central Oregon and Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties are just two examples of communities here in Oregon that have track records of bringing various community stakeholders together to design and implement community-driven health promotion initiatives. These and other community health collaborative efforts all around our state can and do play an essential role in improving population health. Oregon can't effectively address health care reform and the escalating costs of health care without addressing the problems of the delivery system and addressing chronic disease and obesity. Oregon's SHIP will help community health collaboratives throughout the state by awarding small yet very significant grants to innovative community-based prevention activities focused on chronic disease. These grants will create and support prevention initiatives that are community-driven and require local stakeholders, both public and private, to work collaboratively as well as share a commitment to improve health outcomes, especially for those at greatest risk of chronic disease. Hospitals cannot do it alone. Safety net clinics cannot do it alone. Insurers cannot do it alone. Public health departments cannot do it alone. Businesses can't do it alone. Creating healthy communities and populations require diverse local stakeholders coming together and working collaboratively. SHIP is a wonderful example of the state partnering and supporting community health innovations that are evidence-based, leverage private dollars, and focus on prevention and positive health outcomes. Consequently, SHIP is a wise investment for Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, and there may be questions later. With that, I'd like to call up Pam, Malia Mason, Jennifer Pratt, John Saltz, and Glenn Rodriguez, although we only have three chairs.
Sit in each other's laps. Did you want to hold questions?
Go ahead.
What was the best way to do that? We had a lot of people to
why don't you ask your question so that they can be thinking about it or maybe answer it here?
Madam Chair, just while people are coming up, I think most of us support 4, 5, 6. It's important we move in this direction. I do have questions that I think we'll be hearing more about this morning about certification and funding for this program. I think Dr. Wopat hit on one thing of this to be, just to be something that's required probably. And many of our Med-Eng care plans are really already doing this. So I'd like to hear more about what people think a medical home really is, how that integration occurs. And I'm going to be listening also that we broaden the aspects of this to include mental health, drug and alcohol, and social issues, which have to be part of the issues you deal with in a medical home to really be effective. It's not just a matter of trying to do physical health in these homes. You've got to go way past that if you're going to have an impact on the population serving. And I know that some of our managed care plans are actually working in those areas already. So I'm interested to hear testimony this morning.
And I know that, Pam, you said that you had a video that would maybe set the stage for what it was like.
Our joint work, Chairman Sanderson, Pam Marion Nason from CareOregon. So for OPCA and CareOregon's portion of testimony, we're going to cede some time and work around so that we can show the video that I think sets the stage for some of the work we're doing and opens for Q&A later.
Okay.
But that'll be a little different than Dr. Rodriguez or Dr. Saltz.
And who goes first?
Greetings, Chairman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is John Saltz, and I'm professor and chairman of the Family Medicine Department at OHSU. For the past 23 years, I've made my living training family physicians to practice in our state, including rural communities around the state. And I'm here today to explain to you why I think Senate Bill 456 is perhaps the most important bill the legislature is going to consider in terms of laying a framework in place for how the health system will change over the next several years in our state. First, a context. The most important problem in American healthcare today is that the care costs more than the American people can afford, and increasingly is costing more than businesses can afford. That problem is a first-order public policy problem, and it affects every state in the union, including Oregon. Now, the scientific evidence is quite conclusive that health systems that are based on a primary care foundation deliver better population health outcomes at a lower cost. And this is not really something that informed people can disagree about, I don't think. The literature, the research evidence is quite clear. Primary care needs to be defined, and it really is based on five important attributes. That it's highly accessible and convenient to people. They don't have to struggle with getting the phones answered when they want an appointment. That it's based on healing relationships between providers and patients that extend over time. That it's comprehensive enough that the majority of the patient's problems can be handled without referrals. That it's coordinated and managed when patients are hospitalized and need specialty care. And that it's delivered in a contextually sensitive way to the community and the patient's culture and family. The primary care system in this state is in bad trouble today. It is not able to perform those five attributes successfully for five basic reasons. The overhead cost in these practices is too high. The reimbursement cost to the practices given those overhead costs are too low. The primary care system was designed primarily to care for acute medical problems like sore throats or twisted ankles, and increasingly with the aging population, the problems that it's dealing with are chronic medical problems like congestive heart failure and hypertension. And finally, the primary care system has lacked access to sophisticated information technology that would allow them to know how they're doing with their practice. So at least in those five ways, the primary care system is not working well. Patient-centered medical homes are a national movement being discussed in most of the states of the United States now. In Oregon, we're referring to this concept as an integrated health home. This is essentially a plan to redesign and transform the primary care system to one that will be more effective. So getting started on that process, we're going to have lots of partners with us around the United States. A lot of people are studying and writing about this now. What we know currently about medical homes are that it involves an expansion of the scope of primary care to include the integration of competencies that we would currently define as mental health and public health and chemical dependency treatment, that it involves a much enriched information environment with regards to 21st century information systems for those practices, and it includes a much enhanced process of care for chronic disease management, in addition to the current attributes that primary care has. Now, current evidence would suggest from national data that somewhere around a quarter of the primary care practices in this state would be able to function as a medical home today. There is no clear agreement on how to measure this. There's no clear definition of what a medical home ought to be. And so I think one of the things I would leave with you today is this is an evolving concept. This is being defined. Oregon should embrace and pursue a program of medical research in this area. And our department and our university at OHSU are very committed to that. There are others that are studying this in the state, including the Kaiser Center for Health Research. But as those attributes become clear and our ability to measure them becomes more sophisticated, it's very important that every primary care practice in this state be transformed in the way that I'm talking about. We'll also have problems with having an adequate workforce to staff the primary care system, which is why some clear pathway to adequately funding this transformation is very important in terms of getting medical students and nursing students and psychology students to be interested in working in such places. Essentially, in the long run, transforming these practices will take several years. It will take substantial work on the part of the practices, and it will involve a partnership between the people who are actually doing the work at the point of care and the people who are defining policies and paying for the care at the level of the insurance system and the state. So this is an important bill that establishes Oregon's leadership in this area, and I would urge you to support it and would be happy to answer your questions later.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Thank you. And Senators, thank you for the chance to speak today. My name is Glenn Rodriguez. I'm a family physician and geriatrician. My practice in East Portland. And I speak today as President-elect of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. We first want to express our support for Senate Bill 456. As Dr. Saltz has articulately expressed, a healthy primary care system, I believe, is really the only thing that can simultaneously expand access to care and control costs. But also in supporting Dr. Saltz's comments, primary care in Oregon is in crisis. We are not functioning up to our capacity and potential. We can do better, and we've polled our members and asked, and our members want to see change and want to be engaged in this process and want to be part of of the positive change. Transformation of primary care practice in Oregon is possible. I believe it is possible across all practice styles and settings, and that's one area we want to emphasize. The integrated health home movement is not just for one segment of the population. This is the principles around which we should restructure primary care in Oregon. And it can apply to all practice settings, large and small. Our specialty has sponsored a national demonstration project which found some of the most successful practices were actually small practices in making this transformation. Really, that transformation has to be built on these principles of integrated health home, but fundamentally is built on the principles, the sound principles of primary care that are not new. These are our values. These are what we believe in, what we want to do, and what we want to get back to doing. They are built on new infrastructure and new approaches, especially a focus on chronic illness management and integration of behavioral health care, and fully the development of team-based care and practice settings. I personally believe one of the weaknesses of our current setting is the weakening, really, of the teams in primary care offices. For example, I think nursing expertise is much less represented than it was 20 years ago and a very critical part of the team in achieving these objectives. I think the state has an important role as represented in Senate Bill 456. I think the common approach to certification is really important to our members. They want one set of rules and one way to do this. So the state's role in a common certification and setting standards around which will be judged, I think, is really important. Also, I believe the state should make sure we create environments where collaboration can occur across all segments, purchasers, providers, insurers, a safe harbor environment where they can collaborate on common models of integrated health home funding. I just want you to understand what the potential power of primary care, and I believe primary care represents the last good deal in healthcare. Currently, across the system, we invest less than $1 per day in primary health care services. That's a dollar a day in primary health care services, and there's huge health care expenditures that you look at. And I believe we can make this transformation to integrated health homes with this order of magnitude additional investment. And I think the value is enormous. So my message to the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, we want to be engaged in this process. We believe change is necessary. We believe these principles are the right principles. And we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Monta Sanderson, Senators. My name is Jennifer Pratt. For the record, I'm the... What am I? All of a sudden, what am I? The Director of Policy of the Oregon Primary Care Association. And you have a handout from me, but I'm going to cede my time for the most part to Dr. Nick Gideon, who will introduce himself, because I think his testimony is much richer and will enliven what you're hearing today from all of the various people. So just wanted to make sure you all knew that we represent 127 clinics across the state in Gresham and Eugene and Roseburg and Medford and Benton as well. And we are deeply involved in the integrated health home effort and very excited about the indicators of it. So with that, I will cede my time. Nick?
Hi. Chairman Moss Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Nick Gideons. I'm with OHSU's Richmond Clinic, a federally qualified look-alike clinic. I also want to state that I come to this from the perspective of having practiced in Cottage Grove, Oregon, for 8 years, where in many ways we, as a rural practice, you provide an integrated health home for your community. We've been very fortunate to collaborate with Care Oregon and other safety net clinics in a primary care renewal project trying to create the integrated health home, and are very excited about the outcomes we've had. I'm going to describe some of the process that we've been through and why uniform standards and measures and support is required to be able to spread this model further and to follow up on the early successes we have. We're going to start with a different part of the presentation right now, however.
Okay. Well, again, I'm Pam Mary Nason from Care Oregon, Director of Health Policy, and Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members, thank you for hearing us. What you're going to hear in our video is really a resonation with all of the speakers that we've heard so far this morning. We're going to spend some time listening to
partners and the community. We see these folks that are doing world-class health care, and it's really something that we...
Go fast. Yeah.
...that we can and should and are compelled to do ourselves.
A typical day was me arriving 10 to 20 minutes late. I raced in the door. I had a stack of charts. I knew I had a stack of charts waiting in medical records for me. I would walk into the room. I'd open the chart, maybe before I walked in the room, and glance at the name.
What was I supposed to do?
And then I also just had this incredible burden of backlogged work. As a physician, I was all alone, having to accomplish those tasks.
I felt stressed out doing things for the doctor. That was kind of hard because I didn't have an idea of how to do everything organized.
At the front desk, boy, it could get crazy up there.
It was stressful. It was very stressful, busy.
I was looking for a new job.
Okay.
Before primary care renewal, it was good. I loved being a doctor, but I wasn't nearly as effective as I am now.
Well, I think it's clear that the system doesn't work for anyone. Some people really don't need a visit with a doctor, but that's the only thing that's paid for.
And so we're now finding ourselves in a mix of a broken health care system and people who can't access it.
What's going on? Diabetes, congestive heart failure, high blood pressure, yeah, that stuff. I raised my insurance about once a month until I got to about $800. I could no longer afford it.
So you're uninsured?
Totally uninsured. Business fell off, so I'm scraping by.
It's hard to fix because it's a complex system. There are many actors, both giving care, receiving care, and it's been hard in the past to activate that many parties around a common goal.
And someone has to sort of say, I can see that it could be some other way. And that's really what Dave did. He basically said, we're going to take 30 people to Alaska and figure this out. It was one of those crazy ideas that it was absolutely right.
Dr. Gideons and myself went to the South Central Foundation. They had what was called patient panels. Their registered nurses worked side by side with clinicians, with medical assistants, with LPNs, and they were doing futuristic work, proactive care, bringing the patient in when they hadn't been seen recently. That model made real sense for our clinic and for the patient population.
We all knew that this was the model that we wanted to move towards. We could taste it, we could feel it, we could smell it. We needed to make the change, and so whatever it took.
You pulled your chair? Okay.
A typical day now is so much better. I've taken some time to review my chart so that we can all kind of hear what's going on, interact, get charts pulled.
As far as the flu vaccine, let's give it to them.
You can basically just come into one room and find all of her support.
I really enjoy my job. I feel like I'm doing a better job as a physician.
Perfect.
I feel like I'm supported here as a team player. And I feel like I do a better job for those people that I'm here to serve.
It's fantastic.
So this is your antibiotic?
I'm getting in faster. I don't have to wait 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay, until they're gone.
And if I have an emergency, I can see a doctor right away also, which is nice.
It sort of created a safety net, I think, for their health care needs, and I think the patients have felt that difference as well.
Yeah, it seems like the people who work here want to work here. They're here because they want to be here, and that's really impressive.
Looking at the faces of the nurses that work here, I think they love their jobs more now than they did then.
But we're making something that you can continue to do, not just for 6 months, not just for a year, but as part of your nursing career, and continue to be happy and feel like when you go home at the end of the day, I made a difference in the life of a patient.
We're really reaching people before they get to crisis and sort of establishing that relationship and establishing that network.
I do still feel like I'm dealing with acute needs, but there's time to say, by the way, how are you doing with your new diabetic blood sugar monitor, and is that working out? And do you need an appointment? And we have the access to give people appointments when they really do need them.
Data shows from February to now, the number of patients who've needed to utilize the emergency room has decreased.
Bravo. Other clinics are using us as a model now. Next year, we will have all of our nursing positions not carried on grant dollars at all. They'll be carried on our operational budget. We've been able to prove that the model can be sustained.
After about 8 months, when we'd been doing this work with all the pilot teams, suddenly we heard that one of the clinics was going to move the model from one team to the whole clinic. when I heard that they were willing to put their whole clinic in this new model, I knew that we were really had found something that was really tapped into what was important to everyone.
I mean, I think bringing modern technology and the different tools that are out there to primary care is a new field. We didn't have that when we didn't have our data systems. We had no other way to do it. We had a telephone, and we had paper and pen. That's it. So how can you study a population, and more importantly, how can you improve or renew primary care if you don't even know what you're taking care of? Here's an example of a provider panel. With that manageable panel, you can actually start seeing and trending that population and data outcomes. And that's a very different way of thinking. I can look at it from an individual user, one patient to one provider, to a population of an entire system. It's not just about you seeing your patient in that visit. It's about your patients and your panel of patients that you see an outreach to on the times they don't come in. When I go to work, there is a group of patients that myself and my team are taking care of.
Every community, every practice has to adjust it and fit it to its own local culture. It isn't like there's something that's given on high. It has to come organically from the practice itself.
Now we're working as a team, and the team gets to make the decisions. So I think that's the paradigm shift, is going from somebody else deciding for us to us getting to decide.
What would you say to me?
Our team function is to really create a learning organization for the clinical teams so that they can learn how to be teams and also learn how to accomplish the objectives that they have and the patient outcomes for the population that they serve. It's through constant learning and taking a look at what we did, evaluating what we did, organizations are able to really design the work that they're doing. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was help people develop their skills around communicating on a daily basis and also managing.
So clearly there's more to the video, but out of respect for time today, we're going to stop it there. And we think that at least sort of sets the stage and gives an understanding of the work that the clinicians have been doing. And we wanted to make sure that we do go on record saying we all support this bill and that we've been working very hard on doing this and are interested in sharing more of that experience as time allows in the future. We do have work that's now happening around payment reform from the health plan perspective, which is what we're doing here, of course. We have started to experiment with paying differently for some of the work that you just heard discussed this morning. There's a handout in front of you, and I will let you look at that at your leisure that speaks to the different tiers that we are currently using for our payment reform. And there's a gold sheet in front of you that speaks to the type of information, in fact, the specific information right now that we're using for the 2009 phase of the project with our clinicians and the difference in our payment methodology. Yes, it looks like this. So this will show you some of the measures that are being collected now. We spent much of 2008, and you'll see that information in front of you, actually learning how to collect the data at the clinical level. I think it might not be as obvious that for the most part, clinicians are not trained in having to collect this data and didn't have an infrastructure to do that. So it took us a lot of work to figure out how to get to the point of being able to make sure that we're collecting data at the clinic level, what data to collect, who's going to collect it, how it's going to look, so that we could then move into the phase of beginning to pay differently for that, which we did in January. And with that, I'll turn some time over here.
Thank you. I want to talk a little bit more about the amount of work that it takes to adopt this integrated health home model, where the support that would be available through Senate Bill 456 would be so useful in spreading this work further, in a sense of what I think the future can hold for it. As I said, we were fortunate with Care Oregon's support and the partnership with the other four clinics that you saw in the video to begin to do our own work around defining what integrated health home meant and implementing implementing that. And some of the things you've heard are about really improving access through this project. We've expanded our evening hours and our availability on Saturday. But more to the point, it takes a lot of management around our management team as well as all our providers to make sure that the really ready access is available. The team-based care that you've heard emphasized here takes, again, a strong investment. Each of your small teams, a few providers, a nurse, the medical assistants who work with them, the folks that do the scheduling, need to meet and invest on a regular time, taking away perhaps from some of that time where you're running the treadmill of visits and being responsive and reactive, to mapping out your access and really looking at how you can be available to your patients at the right time, at the right place, when they need it. Integrating behavioral health, which was emphasized less in the visit, but for us is an important definition and a big challenge in a primary care doctor's office about how you bring together the right resources, whether they're other behavioralist social workers, other levels of mental health care, so that, as Dr. Smith had mentioned, you bring those with serious or less serious mental illnesses together with where their primary care is integrated in a patient-centered way, and then as you heard Dr. Shaw saying in the visit, how you begin to take the time to plan around your population and have the tools in place, which is not simple. Electronic records have helped a lot, but that's still an investment that many primary care homes are making. You need context for that. You need the collaborative that Care Oregon and those four partners or OPCA is trying to bridge and send out to those other hundreds of clinics to get a sense of how you can approach this and bite this off. And it's not by single payer group. Richmond Clinic is very fortunate. We've evolved from a university clinic with a higher insured rate of population to being able to care for more Medicaid and managed care and uninsured patients over the last few years, and we've been very fortunate in that. But we can't divide up those people. They shift from one insurance basket to another. We need consistent measures and guidelines across that. And again, a statewide effort such as 456 envisions would really help us define and further decide what the criteria is that we can meet, not just what one particular managed insurer is trying to reach in its particular quarter. So what are some of our successes have been? You have in front of you on the Care Oregon data an example, an easy one to measure, of where our diabetics have been at Richmond Clinic since we've adopted this approach. We've been able to expand the number of patients we've served from about 8,500 at the beginning of this project to 10,000 without additional providers. Like the fact that we've been able to stay open in what's a very hard environment for patients to provide new medical homes tells us that we're doing something right about that. But I also want to give some context to the support. The grant support from Care Oregon that got this project started for us was about 3-4% of our annual budget. The payment reform around that is helpful, but it's still only 1-2% of our annual budget. We need the space and the room to do that kind of planning, to do the investment in looking at our population as a whole. 456 will help us begin to define what that is, how to measure it across places, and how to propagate it further.
Thank you. We have, right now, we're just hearing testimony. We aren't able to have a conversation, which is really difficult in a public hearing. And there are evidently amendments proposed, but I do want to get through with the people who are here. And so I would like to, there are three more proponents, Jim Russell, Dave Fiskin, and Dave Rosenfeld. They could come forward, and then we'll have people come up who have concerns about the bill.
Madam Chair,
Dave is with the last group, so... I mean, Dave Rosenfeld, you're against concerns. So let's just have Dave Fiskin and Jim Russell.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your sensitivity of your time here, and I'm going to hold any questions to the end because we'll never get through this otherwise. But I don't want my silence to be registered as accepting everything in the bill. I like the bill a lot, but there are some real problems inside that I think we'll be discussing later.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Jim Russell. I'm a director for one of the Oregon Health Plan mental health organizations, regional mental health organization, called the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. It's not in that role that I come in front of you again today, but as an advocate for over 25 years for people with a serious mental illness. There's a lot in this bill, as you heard me remark in relation to Senate Bill 156. My great hope about integrated health care is it will address this grave health injustice that I've outlined here in this document, that people with serious mental illnesses, it's well documented, including in this state, are dying on an average of 25 years sooner than a matched population, that their relative risks of the kind of chronic conditions that you've been hearing about this morning are 2 to 5 times the general population. I did bring this document to you before, but it has a backside now. I gave you some verbal presentation of the barriers to self-care in this population, some of the system barriers, and the special difficulty that having psychiatric symptoms presents directly in the transaction of receiving health care. So this population is gravely disadvantaged, and it's my hope that you will pass this on as your expectation is of a quality measure that you want to see integrated health care achieve. And I'll probably see you again in the hall and everything asking you to do that. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health System. Mr. Dewey, as I came up, advised me to be brief, and so I'm following his orders again. I'll be very brief. I was out of the room for early testimony, so I didn't hear some of the things you've heard, but it is important for Providence to go on record with regard to its support for this bill. I do so by giving you a letter signed by the CEO of our system in Oregon, Russ Danielson, who... And I'll just read you quick excerpts of this because it is a short letter. We believe that there is an opportunity for Oregon to encourage the development of integrated health homes. Private health insurance interests already are creating pilot models for this type of care. We hope the state will encourage public-private collaboration using the best expertise in the healthcare community and supporting models with the greatest potential in carefully designed pilot programs. We encourage you that before you embark on a certification program, we believe there's great value in first identifying best practices in other states that have adopted standards, evaluation tools, and reimbursement plans. That work will be important, including work done by the National Committee for Quality Assurance. And pilots would then inform the state about how to go about this or whether you need to build a certification program or instead become an expert resource with an established set of guidelines for best practice. Our caution at the end of the letter is a caution we make on all bills coming to you that may have a fiscal impact, which is to be careful that needed state programs serving marginalized and fragile populations be given priority over creating new, currently unfunded programs where a decision must be made between the two in light of the reality of the economic and budget and revenue circumstances we all face in this state. That said, Madam Chair, be pleased to answer questions, but I suspect those will be at a different moment than right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Now we will have Dave Rosenfeld, and then Jonathan Eames has a contingency of MDs, too. So Dr. Rosenfeld.
Contingency. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Dave Rosenfeld with Osberg. I'll make my comments very, very short since there's people far more knowledgeable about the actual substance of integrated health homes and have done years and years of research on it. Bottom line is that in this economy, Oregonians are getting hammered by rising health care costs, premiums, out-of-pocket deductibles. This has become a central consumer problem for Oregonians, and cutting health care costs has to be central in our attempt to fix the healthcare problem. There are three major strategies we can go about doing, which have been outlined in the Oregon Health Fund board report, which is excellent. And then integrated health homes is a key part of that strategy. There's been now ample evidence that shows that there's huge amounts of cost savings that we can get from this. So from our perspective, this bill is excellent. It's a good way to go. And that's what we got to say.
Okay. So Osberg is supporting this bill?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Now, Jonathan Eames, Dr. James Begg, Dr. Larry Sharp, and Dr. Lyle Jackson is with that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames from PacWest Communications, but here on behalf of COHO, the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is a coalition of managed care plans from around the state, serving about half of the OHP population in the state. And I just want to start out, I'm not going to talk very much because we have a number of providers here that are here to testify on this. But I think it's important to start out in saying, just like Senator Bates mentioned, the concept of integrated health homes and the underpinnings of what Care Oregon and the other groups are trying to achieve, we're very supportive of. What we have issues with or concerns about is the structure of the bill and what it's actually trying to achieve. And I think a number of these people here are going to testify to that. That, in fact, they like integrated health homes and the concept so much, they do a lot of this already and want to talk about those programs as well. So in looking at this legislation and as we move forward, we want to just make sure that we're doing it in the appropriate way, we're doing it in the most fiscally responsible way in a budget scenario that's terrible at best, and we want to work with this committee and with the legislature to develop programs and ideas that are included in this legislation, but in a proper way that's not prescriptive and actually ties to things that are tangible rather than things that we don't know. Previous testimony earlier on talked about we don't know exactly how many folks would actually qualify for a certification, and that's a concern. It's also a concern that we don't know exactly what we're talking about. If this is the beginning of a conversation, great. We want to be a part of it, and we want to be active in this role. But as written, that's where we have concerns with the bill. So I'm going to actually have Dr. Baumer come up here first and speak, and then I'm going to get out of the way. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm members of the committee. Thanks for inviting us. I'm David Baumer. I'm the medical director at Mid-Valley IPA for Quality Insurance. As Mr. Eames has pointed out, we are very much in favor of the intent of this bill. In fact, for the last 10 years, we have been developing programs that would fit within the definition of a medical home or patient-centered home, and as have all of the other fully capitated health plans in the state. But we have concerns about this bill because we don't see that there is a very strong correlation between the testimony that you have heard and necessarily the way that the language of this bill has been written. And I think the question before the committee is this bill the vehicle that we need in order to get us to the place that we all agree we need to get to in the future? The fully capitated health plans have been doing a great service in managing this population since the start of the Oregon Health Plan. And I think there should be some recognition in the bill that we have already come a great distance in improving the quality of health care that's provided in the state, but there needs to be some improvement. We are concerned that the bill as written would constrict access to health care should some communities and some providers not be able to qualify and be certified as providers, and the good work that they have done would be lost. So I'm going to pass on to my fellow members here and let them add other comments.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm Larry Sharp. I'm a family physician out of Roseburg, and one of the things that has concerned me in this horrific economic downturn is that I look at what the federally qualified health plans are currently doing, and I'd like to comment a little bit about what we're doing in Douglas County without any additional funds. We have taken what we could from managing medical care in Douglas County, and we have promulgated an electronic health record across the community. We think what we have done is unique in the United States, and that we have kept practice management data completely separate at the same time that we have a single chart model. So like you find in university settings where a patient has one chart that goes everywhere, in our community we have one chart. So whether the patient sees a cardiologist or sees a primary care doctor, the same chart is always accessed. We now have extremely good cooperation and penetration in the community. Probably close to 80% of our providers in Douglas County are on the same electronic health record. With that, we have developed a significant informatics system that will enable disease management of the kind envisioned by the integrated health model. If you look at the NCQA standards for what a medical home really is, the first two levels of certification almost entirely revolve around information systems. And so this has been a roadblock in primary care just because of the cost of implementing such systems. And it's not enough just to have an electronic medical record, because if one just has an electronic chart, one really hasn't gained anything. The real power of an electronic medical record is one that is integrated with other health systems within the community. Let me tell you that right now we are integrating our electronic health record not only with all the specialists and the hospitals. Every lab in Douglas County is already has interfaces to the system. We are working with the community health department to integrate mental health and their aspect of care within our electronic health record, and our federally qualified health clinic also is coming on our system, and by the end of this week we'll be up and running. So we feel very confident that we are already, without any additional funds and without any additional legislation, we are already moving in that model. It was mentioned by Mr. Shook about mental health earlier and integration of mental health. We decided that this was very important, and so we placed in our largest primary care clinic, we have placed a mental health provider who is actually there to intervene on a minute-by-minute basis should the need arise. And this was done, again, without external definition of a medical home or legislation that would force us to do that. I guess my point is that without any additional funds, we have taken the concept and are continuing to evaluate and promulgate the concept of a medical home, and we're trying to move that throughout Douglas County and hope that we can continue to do so. In support of the concept, I'm not in support of the bill, and I would make that clear. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, but as members of the committee, I'm Lyle Jackson, Dr. Jackson. I'm a family practice doctor from Grants Pass. I started practice in 1977 and became the medical director, or IPA, in the year 2001. Like previous testimony, we are in favor of the concept of this bill. We believe I'm a very strong primary care advocate as a primary care physician. Grants Pass, Josephine County, Southwest Oregon has always been a primary care deficient area, and so anything that strengthens the primary care network is good for our community. There has to be more emphasis on primary care, and the integrative medical home provides that emphasis. And I'm glad that trend is finally happening, not only in the state, but across the country. Like the SIPA, the Mid-Rogue IPA is doing similar things to develop that integrated medical home. We, too, are developing a community-based electronic medical record without any funds, without any grants, without any gifts. It was solely at the support of the physicians, where approximately half of our membership is already involved in the integrated with electronic medical system. We're also hooked up with various labs, hospitals, and other ancillary providers in the community. So we're taking a huge step in that direction. We also, as an IPA, as a fully capitated health plan, we have the structure to support especially small doctors' offices in rural areas of our in our network to provide integrative services, including disease management, complex case management, behavioral health integration, wraparound social services, also helping with transportation needs to provide a full integrated health system based on our primary care network. Again, we support the concept of the bill. I feel personally that this bill pigeonholes what integrated medical home is. I think the strength of primary care in the state is based on a local input from the physicians, a local buy-in, and I'm concerned that having a state agency certifying what is a primary care home will be a detriment for young physicians and nurse practitioners to practice in our part of the state, having going through another loop which to be certified. I feel that doctors and nurse practitioners are licensed, certified already, and to have another hoop to be certified as an integrated medical home is not necessary. Thank you.
Questions for this panel?
Oh, you want questions?
Well, we have one more from your group, correct? Yeah, and then yes.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Beggs. I'm a family physician from Klamath Falls. I'm also a medical director of Cascade Comprehensive Care, the local fully capitated health plan for the Oregon Health Plan there. I've been practicing there for the past 23 years. Prior to that, I was in Montana. I was a delegate to the American Academy of Family Physicians from Montana. Since being here, I've worked with OMPRO, subsequently Acumentra, and I'm the immediate past chair of Acumentra. I've been very involved in the cause for primary care and for quality for many years, and have tried to use what position I have in Klamath Falls and in the state to help promote these changes. And I think that that's one concept that is important to mention, is that we all realize that these changes are coming, that they're all important. I couldn't agree more with the testimony of the people who testified in favor of the bill with respect to the necessity for a medical home, a patient-centered primary care medical home. I do object to the term integrated health home on the basis of the fact that it is apparently chosen specifically to avoid the physician, when most of the research that has been quoted previously is based on a primary care physician-centered medical home, and that's really where the where a good deal of savings are. I think it was very well stated by Dr. Saltz that the position of primary care is waning because of inadequate funding, and that we need to figure out some way to reimburse that. I'm afraid that the concept in this bill, however, is turning into an administrative medical home rather than a primary care medical home, and indeed is creating an additional unnecessary bureaucracy that is trying to support this, which I'm afraid will be at wasted expense to the state. I applaud my colleagues who have taken steps to create integrated health home ideas in their own communities. Klamath Falls is probably lagging somewhat in that. We do have very independent physicians, but we are gradually moving in that direction too. Some of the things that I tried to do in the mid-90s are now being requested by the physicians that were resisting it back then. So I'm looking forward to the change that's coming as we move toward an era of the medical home, and I certainly hope the state can find ways of supporting this
both legislatively and fiscally in hopefully better times, but at this point I do not feel that this is the appropriate bill or vehicle to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. I'd like to take a few minutes now for questions. And first, there are some amendments, and so we need to have someone who can address the amendments. Dr. Saltz, can I have you come back up here from OHSU? And Dr. Bates has some questions. But is there someone that can talk to the amendments and then also to address some of the questions overall? Because it looks like we're going to maybe need a work group to have these ideas and concepts and concerns be at one table, and if Mr. Shook could sort of coordinate through Dr. Smith and Jonathan Eames in getting the players to the table, that would be extremely helpful. All right. To the amendments first, could you just address those? And
Chair Melissa Anderson, members of the committee, you have the hand engrossed versions, and in essence, the majority of the amendments were based on the health equities recommendations, just to be more diverse in terms of our thinking. We've recommended these in all of our Oregon Health Fund Board bills, just to address that, making sure that it's an explicit thinking about in terms of disparities. I can go through them in more detail, but basically the first one is about being more making sure that culturally competent and linguistically appropriate care is part of what we would want as appropriate health outcomes in an integrated health home model. And similar for the next, the second one there. The page 2, section 2, we added some language, again, as I mentioned before, in terms of as funds are available. Initially in the proposed budget from DHS, there was a separate policy option package for significant more dollars put into the Medicaid program to be able to augment and enhance payments. Unfortunately, that didn't make it into the governor's recommended budget. So having this language makes this bill less have a less of an elevated fiscal. Now, this doesn't mean that there couldn't be additional dollars through other vehicles, such as House Bill 2009 or others that would enhance payments that could be structured, and that the department would then, it really directs it that the department would adjust their payment structure towards incentivizing the development of integrated health homes. I think in some of the concerns is that the essence of this bill really is to try to get some uniformity and sharing of best practices. Everyone's doing a lot of great work in the state, and we did a comprehensive look at this for the Health Fund Board's Delivery Committee of what was going on across the state, and we have a several-page brief that summarizes it. But this really isn't making everyone do it. It's really like, if you're going to do it, let's all do it and have the same health outcomes. We had a similar discussion in the Delivery Committee about certification. And we know that the NCQA certification is expensive. Experiences in other states, such as Pennsylvania, is they found that they're not going to ask their clinics to do this right off the bat. They want to get them going, ask to do some of the similar sort of health outcomes, and then eventually maybe there is a national certification that we all want to go with. But we don't want to put a burden of $30,000 on a clinic and a lot of paperwork. But what Pennsylvania's experience was is we can work towards that end or some common certification. We wanted to kind of get away from certifying as much as we wanted to get a common set of outcomes. We could all expect that that's what we get for giving for our payments. That this is the kind of, we want to see all of our diabetics get hemoglobin A1Cs and monitor their diabetic care more closely. We want to, you know, some of them are process outcomes and some of them hopefully will be true health outcomes. But the certification, we don't, and back in early days of practice, we all tried to get quality certified and it was a lot of paperwork, it was a lot of hassle. My clinic partners just kind of, oh my God, how can we do this? This isn't what this is about. This is like setting some common standards that everyone sits around the table and we look at the best of what people are doing. There may be some specific one for children that are going to be a little different from some conversations I've had with pediatricians, and there may be other ones for what we'd expect from clinics that maybe focus more on mental health and addictions. But you know, trying to get some common standards and build on what's already been done in the state, what's being done on a national level, what's being done in other states. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. It's just getting some common, mutually agreeable on standards that then the payment reform directives could reinforce that as an incentive. So that's basically what the amendments try to do, health inequities, and trying to make sure that there isn't a huge fiscal on this particular bill so we can get started down this road. Okay. All right, questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Saltzman, I'm not picking on you, okay? I just thought you were sort of the point of the spear here on some questions I had, and I thought you'd be in the best position to answer those questions. And it's an opportunity to get some things on the record, too. And just as to tell you where we're coming from here, I'm part of a 32-member doctor group that's in primary care. And what we're talking about here today, if I were to lay that on the board meeting tonight, which is going to occur at 7 o'clock, and I won't be there, thank goodness, they would think that I just lost my mind, okay? Just lost my mind. That's how far apart I think we are from many of the people that we deal with every day as far as primary care is concerned. But you're in a training program, and you're in a position to change those attitudes with graduates coming through. So a couple of questions first. The biggest barrier I see to working towards an integrated home is having enough providers, either nurse practitioners or physicians. And right now the biggest barrier to that, I believe, is how we pay people. Would you be in a position to support knowing that we're not going to hugely expand pay to physicians, that we start adjusting between subspecialty, specialty care, and primary care, how we pay physicians, and to be blunt about it, to cap or reduce specialty care pay and to increase primary care pay?
So you're asking whether I would be in favor of that? I think as a matter of public policy, it's impossible to justify spending more aggregate health dollars on health care. If we're going to increase funding for something, it implies that there needs to be decreased funding for something else. I get asked this question by medical students pretty often. There's plenty of examples of waste in healthcare. There's lots of money spent on administration. There's lots of profits taken by pharmaceutical companies and hospital systems. And there's also a widening disparity among the physician population in how physicians are paid, and that is symbolically very important to medical students. So narrowing the gap between the income of specialists and the income of primary care doctors, I believe, is an important step in encouraging student interest in primary care careers.
Follow-up question? Mm-hmm. Could you give us some idea of what that gap looks like, knowing that specialists get 2 to 3 years more training than primary care physicians do? And we're looking at training for primary care that now expands as a minimum at least 7 years, medical school and residency training. Some residencies go to 4 years, and sometimes there's a fellowship after that. But for the most part, it's 2 or 3 years more of training, which you, by the way, are paid during that time you're doing your fellowship and residencies. Give me an idea of what that gap looks like now.
So the average income in the United States for a family physician is about $150,000 or $160,000 a year. And in the most highly remunerative specialties, that the average income approaches $500,000 a year on average for the specialty. There's published data about that, and I don't have it in front of me right now, so I could certainly get it for you to be specific. But I would say it's about a 4 to 5-fold difference from top to bottom. Family medicine is not the worst paid specialty. I think that psychiatry and perhaps general pediatrics tend to be a little lower. But the group at the bottom end, it does have an influence on attracting students to the field.
Another question. How much time do I have?
This is the meat of it, because okay. In order for the bill to go forward, we've got to have these questions answered.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing these questions. Do you have any particular feelings about laying a certification program on the lowest paid physicians in the system? There's a loaded question for you.
I think that the morale in primary care today is fragile. It's fragile in much the way you're describing with your group. It's one more straw, maybe the straw that breaks the camel's back at many of these practices. So if this rolls out as a certification program with a set of state rules that will mandate them to fill out a bunch of papers, then I think that'd be a disaster. On the other hand, if it rolls out as a statement by the state that what they do matters and is important, and as a collaborative effort to move quality standards forward based on real measurement, and I think one of the things we've lacked in primary care is the ability to really measure and change things, from measuring patient satisfaction in standardized ways to managing diabetic outcomes in standardized ways, I think practices are hungry for those tools, and they're hungry for vehicles in which to share ideas with each other. So it's all in the doing. And part of the reason why I favor the bill is I have a fair amount of trust that we could have some wisdom in how we would do that. I suppose maybe that's misplaced trust, but I tend to be an idealist about that.
And Madam Chair, I think you got to at least start there, or you'll never get past some of the barriers we face in changing how we deliver health care. Dr. Saltz, I'd like to ask you one last question, and we'll let you off the hook here. Well, maybe two questions. First, I would ask you to take part in the work group that the good chair is setting up, and if you had the time to do that, and if she'd accept you as a member of that, I think it'd be helpful.
Okay.
That's the first question. Second question, we've heard from proponents this morning about setting up integrated health homes, and the panel may not be aware that these are all from the Medicaid program. Setting up an integrated health home for the other 75-80% of the population we serve in primary care is a little bit different and has to be spread across that. I want to make a comment that those physicians who take part in the Medicaid program and our local programs that have grown up in the state, which are unique to this state, are not duplicated in any other state union that I know of, have led the field in getting us integrated. Spreading that over the entire practice is really going to be difficult. You may have 5, 10, 15% of your practice being in the Medicaid program, and then there's the rest of the practice. And your real income comes from the rest of the practice for a lot of people. There's going to be a challenge to look at insurers when you have 30 or 40 of them coming at you and telling them, we want to be compensated in some way, shape, or form for having a mental health provider in our office. We want to be compensated in some way, shape, or form for taking care of alcohol and drug difficulties. We want to be compensated for dealing with our patients through the internet or by phone, instead of absolutely having to bring them in every time to gain remuneration to support our practice. Would you comment to those issues for us, please?
Certainly. So I do think it's important that the consideration of this subject be about all Oregonians and not just Medicaid enrollees. And therein lies one of the challenges. Because there are so many different payers with so many different sets of rules, it's sort of difficult to sort of engage in a dance in which everyone can agree with one another. A good friend of mine, and probably the most knowledgeable person in this area in the United States, from Pennsylvania, refers to medical homes, most importantly, as a metaphor. It is a metaphor because providers and payers are wanting something different from the delivery system. And the primary care system badly wants to transform and meet that need. But do we transform the delivery system and then provide money for it, or do we provide money for it and then transform the delivery system? And so when I spoke of trust earlier, everybody, it really is about trust. But I think we're smart enough. You know, the people I talk to in the health plan community on the private sector side are very ready for something new. So maybe what the state can best do here is to actually convene these people. And I think that's how I read the bill. I'm definitely not an expert at reading the details of the language, but I read it as an intent to convene people from the payer side, the community side, and the delivery system side around the idea of fixing this problem together. And I have optimism about that because we're smart people.
Senator Morris, or do you want to follow up?
I think he summed it up very, very well, and I appreciate you taking the time to come today, all of you taking the time to come today. And when I look at areas like Roseburg and Grants Pass, or in a geographical area, they've managed to overcome many of these issues and are moving rapidly towards a true integrated home. I really appreciate that. The rest of us are lagging, and we need to get on the ball here and get on board. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe my question follows the concern that... please stay.
You were dismissed.
Follows the question of Senator Bates. And that has to do with, are we dealing with a structural problem here between managed care and fee-for-service? And can a practice that's focused on the fee-for-service even obtain certification as it's proposed, just because of the structural nature of the relationships that you described between physicians and insurers and the patients, that just doesn't fit the objectives doesn't fit the fee-for-service model. And then my question is, if a clinic does not get certification or physicians certified, what happens?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that I'm ready to say that I favor a certification process. I favor the process of collectively defining what an integrative health home is and encouraging practices to move in that way by making changes in the reimbursement system. I think that the decade of the 1990s and the managed care system has created a very important impact on primary care around what their fears are and concerns are about various forms of risk contracting. So they view fee-for-service payment as sort of a return to something that's easy to understand. You can do fee-for-service payment and pay for other services, like phone calls or email interactions or group visits, which currently are not paid for in the fee-for-service environment. Or you could pay a portion or even all of the payment to primary care on a monthly fee, which is the way many other countries do it. I have very good friends in England. The British National Health System is organized in such a way that they're paid on a monthly basis. I think those kinds of ideas can be investigated, but paying for a broader scope of services and allowing real patient management to happen in the practice is what we're talking about. And there is a variety of vehicles by which that might happen. I don't know if I've answered your question adequately or not.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. It just seems like we have misaligned objectives between managed care and fee-for-service, and I see a structural gap in the way that we're going. The idea of having an integrated primary care home, that's wonderful, but I just don't see the structure as it exists today that will deliver that product, and that's the concern that I have.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Morris, there's a lot of work done by a group, I'm blanking on their name, but Harold Miller is a sort of a guru of health reform. He's going to be here in Oregon on the 26th of March, and he has a lot of discussion working with the large groups of different approaches, this on a national level, where it's a transition, where you transition towards something that maybe works better, and so there isn't that total dysfunctionality. But what do we do with the current system that we could still plod forward and get the quality outcomes and health outcomes we want? And there's interim steps, and I can provide you with a summary of sort of that stepwise approach to get there. You can't turn a switch tomorrow to suddenly perhaps the ideal plan that some people would like, but we can maybe work towards it, realizing that different groups will need to do at different stages of development for that.
I see this bill, the first part of the bill, is basically establishing the Oregon Integrated Home Health Program as a subset for the Office of the Oregon Health Policy and Research to consider. So that's number one. I would assume that the opponents would be on board with that because they believe in the concept. So that's taking UPR to
prescribed by rule criteria regarding a medical Oregon integrated home health program. That's number one. So then the second part is then setting up an advisory committee who represent diverse constituencies and are knowledgeable about the integrated home health design. So that's the second part of the bill. The third part, I think, is the concern regarding the department shall require integrated health homes receiving reimbursements to report on quality measures and, you know, become more prescriptive to those. And then the fourth part is for DHS, Department of Human Services, to support evidence-based community efforts to prevent chronic disease and sort of go into the evidence-based. So I see the bill as really maybe not as onerous except for that one piece. And so that's what I would like you to focus on in your work group on making a bill so that we as a state can go forward with the integrated I always forget because this name's changed, health home program to go forward. And so if you could look at those three or four sections that and tease out that so we can go forward with what it's obviously is being implemented in many, it looks like, practices, clinics now. So that's where I'd like to go with your group, if that's possible. And now, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. To follow up, Madam Chair, on that, because I find more problems in the bill than maybe you do. You just look at Section 1, Sub 1, Sub A calls for a certification, and, you know, I mean, it's there. The concept of a health home, whatever we end up calling it, I think is a great concept. My fear is that we are just setting up more bureaucracy over the top. You know, I think, in my opinion, the state's role in this is to help, not to direct. And I think this is set up. Quite honestly, I'm paranoid about this. So I've been here too long to have much faith in the ability of a state agency that's given authority not to use it. Okay? And this gives them a hell of a lot of authority. And I just don't think that's necessarily the way we want to go. I don't want to see anything that stifles the activities that are going on in a lot of communities to create this system. Should we have clearing houses for best practices, things like that? Absolutely. I fully support that. But I don't want somebody from Portland telling somebody from Klamath Falls what their best practices should be, because different communities have different needs. We need to have a way that we can share information among communities better than we have, so people will know that Roseburg's doing something great and maybe Medford would like to look into it. I guess, you know, this bill, if it's going to move, does need a lot of work, because I think there's a lot of top-down stuff in here, and I'm just not sure in this environment that that's the appropriate way for us to be going.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Well, I came in here thinking there were some irreconcilable differences, but I don't believe that's the case. And I think there are more similarities than differences, and I think you can work something out. I'm very optimistic. I'm a optimist, like you are.
And I take a look at the Oregon health policy and research and the quality of work that has come out of that agency is I think superb, and they are the ones that will be actually dealing with setting up the criteria, and I think certification is a word that
You'll find another
word, or at least or get rid of it.
It's all through here.
But with that, we need to move on, unless there's any other questions, because we will be, I only have, I think, 12 or 13 more meetings, and so we need to deal with these concerns fairly quickly, because I think it's an excellent concept, and it will be, I think, and again, I'm giving my prejudices in the best interest of the patients and Oregonians.
I'm sure. Thank you. In your directions to the work group, I'd like to least entertain the thought that the commercial insurers be brought in, and that not only the amount of pay, but the method of pay be discussed. And the method being probably more important than the amount to these homes, which obviously are primarily, we're talking about nurse practitioners and primary care physicians. I think that's a big piece of this. If you really want to move the system, if you really want to bring health care costs down, if you really want to change how we deliver, you can't just do it in Medicaid. It's got to be much broader than that.
But that may be more than what we can do with this bill, and that will actually, setting up the structure, then they will then be working with the
payment
payers.
Reform actual specifics is a concept as part of the continuation of be it a health authority or
Madam Chair, I'd hope to see that when we hopefully pass 2009 that OOPA will be under that, this will be under that, and one of the direct conversations occurring there will be the method and manner of reimbursement for these people outside of the Medicare program, which really starts moving the system.
Thank you so much, everyone. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 456, and I'm going to open a public hearing on 453. And go ahead.
Madam Chair, 453 has two provisions to it. One is a sunset provision for the board. The other one is the requiring reporting of health-related information from health insurers and third-party administrators. It is my understanding that it's your wishes for this morning that we take testimony on the reporting requirements only, and limit testimony to the reporting requirements, not the sunset provision.
With that, Dr. Janine Smith, Denise Love, and Sean Colmer.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I am still Janine Smith, the Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I have with me Sean Colmer, who is a research manager at the office, and our esteemed guest from the National Association for Health Data Organizations, acronym is NADO. She's the Executive Director, Denise Love. She's joining us here today from Utah, where it's a lot more snow than we had, and she will. I'll have her get to her presentation very quickly. Just as a quick overview, the Office of Health Policy was established to provide oversight to the implementation of the original Oregon Health Plan, which was originally much broader than just Medicaid. In this role, the office provides analysis, technical, and policy support on issues relating to health care costs, quality, and utilization. Senate Bill 453 will enable the office to better fulfill this statutory obligation that's within the OOPR statute, ORS 442.025. that states to foster the cooperation of the separate industry forces. There is a need to compile and disseminate accurate and current data, including but not limited to price and utilization data, to meet the needs of the people of Oregon and improve the appropriate usage of healthcare services. Our office has been collecting inpatient hospital data, discharge data, since 1988 and are beginning to collect ambulatory surgical data since last year. But these are very narrow slices of the pie and give us a very narrow view of healthcare costs and trends. The CMS, the Office of the Actuary at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, released the national per capita health expenditures at the end of February. We are now spending $8,000 per person for healthcare in the state. While we don't have current Oregon-specific numbers, historically, we have been about 90% of the national per capita number. If that holds true, then the estimate my office made in 2006 of what spending would be in the state in 2009 was off by about $5 billion. We thought we'd be at about $20 billion in healthcare spending annually, but if the CMS data is any indication, we are closer to $25 billion now. $25 billion, and we don't know how Oregonians spend their dollars. We don't know much about the variation in cost or quality across the state. There's an old adage that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. We believe that our ability to manage healthcare costs, for instance, by developing an essential benefit package or by implementing meaningful healthcare reform, are hampered by the lack of comprehensive, uniform data collection. And on those cheery notes, I will now pass this over to Denise to talk about her efforts in other states and her experiences with her organization. And then Sean will talk a little bit more about some of the specific aspects of the bill.
It's truly an honor to be here today. I'm Denise Love. I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Health Data Organizations. NADO is a nonprofit membership and educational association established by the Washington Business Group in Health in 1986. So we've been around for a long time. Our mission is to promote and improve healthcare databases in states and to use those databases for the public good, including public availability. A personal note, I spent 9 wonderful years at the Utah Department of Health as director of the Utah Office of Health Data Analysis and working with the Utah Health Data Committee establishing statewide reporting systems in that state. Well, we heard a little bit about what the information needs are, and so I'll talk a little bit about all payer claims databases in states. Again, I think of data as a critical tool and a roadmap for any healthcare reform. Today, 48 states in this country have inpatient hospital discharge data reporting systems, like Oregon. Many of those states have expanded to AMSURG, or ambulatory surgery and emergency department databases. Those data provide useful functions for many things, but for healthcare reform and understanding healthcare cost escalation, they have their limits. So, in states, many states that we'll talk about, this demand for detailed healthcare utilization data beyond the hospital setting has driven a new kind, or I call second generation of data reporting in states. States are using all payer claims databases to supplement their other data that they already have, including their inpatient data. But they're looking at the financial aspects of healthcare delivery, episodes of care, understanding what goes into the episodes of care, and to guide benefit design and planning. Well, I won't get into the minutiae so much of a healthcare claims database, but I wanted to be on the same page. There's a lot of kinds of databases. This is a detailed service level claims database that we're talking about, combined with some limited eligibility data. These data are de-identified, aggregated to provide a macro view over the whole system by payer, by geographic area, by sector. They're used for policy, for consumers, physicians and providers, and for employers. So the whole database really does provide a macro view of the system. Okay, so who's doing what? As of today, the status of all payer claims databases in states, the left-hand column are states with existing all payer claims data systems: Maryland, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Kansas. The asterisk is to say that the models differ across states, but these are states that have committed to solving the political and technical issues related to establishing a statewide claims data system. The middle bar refers to early implementation. Minnesota and Utah are in the early stages of implementation, as is Wisconsin. One point I wanted to make, any state coming up today, those in the far right, the actively exploring, including Oregon, benefit from these states in the left-hand side and the middle side, because these states have worked together and worked long to solve some of these challenges that goes along with putting a complex data system together, and the states coming up after them do benefit. Well, we've had a few lessons learned in these other states. All of these states, and I want to emphasize, do have also an infrastructure that supports inpatient hospital discharge data reporting, and they are not replacing those systems because they are two different systems. So, again, APCDs do not replace but supplement facility reporting systems. The states are using their systems to look at healthcare cost expenditures, support healthcare reform, and look at market and cost information. The states do vary in the scope, and we'll talk about that in a minute, of how much data they do collect, but states do emphasize to me that the value of the data system is not dependent on the complete universe of claims. We want to emphasize to states that are starting up that
rather than spending a lot of resources going for 100% of the insured population, that they go after what is feasible and go and fill in the holes later. You do not need 100% to make these systems work. What are the strengths? I've listed them here. One of them is the availability of the data. The data today are the only feasible source of professional and ancillary claims for the insured population that is readily available. Again, the claims data reporting systems leverage existing connections and data flows established for claims reimbursement. Everybody pays claims. The system is in place for the data flows. This reduces reporting burden on the payers who supply the data, and it takes advantage of standardized formats, codes, and billing relationships. They do, as I said, fill important gaps, charges, payments, member liabilities, private insurance market information, which is largely lacking, inpatient, outpatient, pharmacy, physician, dental, and episodes of care. Like any data system, there are limitations, and we talked about the universe, and there may be more questions about that later, but other common exclusions, denied claims are not included. The uninsured, initially, are not included in these data systems, thus the importance of the facility databases that do capture that information. We have states that are in talks about how to capture that uninsured piece. Premium information is not included. Typically, workers' compensation is not included but could be backfilled in later as the system goes forward. It does not include capitation fees, administrative costs, contractual adjustments, lab test results, out-of-state residents, though some states now are cooperating on cross-border sharing of data. Medicaid in a few states like Oregon with heavy managed care penetration could be problematic, but again, moving forward, if you can't get it initially, maybe over time you can use other strategies for filling that gap. Well, we have a growing body of experience of using statewide all-payer claims databases in states. These are examples from Maryland, New Hampshire, and Maine, and Vermont. States are using the data to assess physician services and reimbursement policies. I heard some talk earlier this morning that a data system like this would be very useful to inform the discussion. Per capita expenditures and utilization for the insured, private payer rates for relative value units, payment for non-participating commercial providers, effectiveness or value of high-cost drugs. Does it really keep people out of the hospital? Does it really keep people out of the emergency department? If so, then it's worth it. If not, it changes that conversation. Employers like these data because they can evaluate total payments, facility, professional, and copay, not just on their system, but across the system. We're seeing quite a few of the states ramping up or actually implementing web pricing tools for the uninsured and the insured. And if we have time, I'll show some examples. And this is very important, is that consumer piece, because as consumers either lose their insurance or lose some of their insurance and pay more out of pocket, they really are hungry for pricing information to for which to base their decisions on. Looking at chronic disease prevalence by payer type, another application we're seeing in New Hampshire is payment rate benchmarking by payer. They don't have the whole context. They think they're maybe getting a good deal, but if you can look across the system, you can look at what others are doing relative to rates for conditions and procedures. And then inpatient migration patterns for outpatient care, which is another piece of the puzzle of understanding how Oregonians use health care. I will go through a few examples and then stop me if I run out of time. But this is from Maine. Maine Health Data Organization's Health Cost website. Of note here, I want to point out the portals. And specifically the portal for the insured and for the uninsured. And for the uninsured, what's in there, four procedures, for leading procedures, are median charges, so that an uninsured person can at least get a price benchmark and not go into a provider or hospital totally unarmed without any information as to what it might cost them. And I think this is an important service that Maine is providing, as is New Hampshire. This is the New Hampshire health cost site, and it has quite a bit of information, and it's Maine, obviously modeled after the New Hampshire site. Again, various portals for pricing of healthcare services, healthcare costs for insured patients, and health costs for uninsured patients. I just played with it and took some screen grabs, and because I ski a lot and run a lot, my knee's been cranky lately, so I always go into the knee sites of what procedures might cost. They're elective, outpatient, and very little information is available typically in a state about those procedures. So I was seeking pricing that day on arthroscopic knee surgery within a radius of a zip code for Anthem in New Hampshire. I just entered a forced benefit deductible and coinsurance of 10%. This is just an example of output for knee surgery, and what's interesting is the variation. The first column is an estimate what you will pay as an insured person. The second column is estimate of what the insurance will pay. The combined payments are in the next column. There is a precision of cost estimate of, you know, high, medium, or low, how much noise there may be in that estimate. The typical patient complexity that went into that pricing, and then contact information. Well, you can see the wide range of variation for an Anthem patient who is getting knee surgery, and I might want to explore what the difference is between going to Salem, which looks like a good deal, versus what I might get at New London and pay quite a bit more for my services, for their services, I'm sorry. Another example, pricing difference by carrier and provider colonoscopy. This is a common procedure, and you can look at by facility and by payer how colonoscopy pricing may vary, and it's not such a huge range, but it does give information to consumers. And there is variation, and these are highlighted. Utah is a state that's actively building an all-payer claims data system, and I've been involved in some of those efforts because NATO is based in Salt Lake City these days. Utah's House Bill 09 has a myriad of healthcare reform initiatives in it, but in my opinion, the most important is that provision that authorizes an all-payer, all-claims database as a foundation for the healthcare reform efforts in that state. And again, understanding the true cost of healthcare is critical for reform to move forward in Utah. Without it, it will be difficult to hold all stakeholders, including consumers, accountable for better health outcomes and greater participation in healthcare decision-making. In summary, the health reporting system is an investment in future policy and market decisions. It leverages existing information and connections. It is not starting from scratch. It is not building something new. It does, and it has been filling important gaps in states with these systems. There is an application base and technical solution base developed by other states, and we're working to transport lessons learned, technologies, and any help that can be given across states, like websites. Maybe a state adopting doesn't have to develop their own website, but could take New Hampshire's template. Again, and states working together will, with common formats, it will facilitate comparable benchmarks, common tools, and information. I have left a couple of resources. One of them is the Regional All-Payer Health Information Council, or RAHFIC, and NAHDO.org.
We can go through some examples. This is a live example out of New Hampshire. Took another state's average for arthroscopy, looked at state A and their state, and if their state just assumed state B's rate, if New Hampshire just reduced the prices to approximate state B or the benchmark state, they would save $1.5 million in that state just on arthroscopy if those prices migrated to the average. Again, New Hampshire is using the data to look at disease burden in the Medicaid population vis-a-vis the commercial population, and clearly Medicaid only has a higher disease burden for coronary artery disease. Similar look at the prevalence by asthma by age in New Hampshire, Medicaid versus commercial. Looking at how the Medicaid claims, S-CHIP, and the commercial claims perform on well-child visits. And they are using HEDIS, but this gives them claim-level detail, and the National HEDIS commercial, the FAR bar, was what they had previously, but now they're able to really drill down and look at commercial claims versus S-CHIP versus Medicaid and find out where the strengths are and how they're doing compared to each other within the state. Again, Medicaid visits, S-CHIP visits, and commercial emergency department visits by age, so they can get a glance into their public and their private market and populations. Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, I don't know if you have specific questions for Denise, since she is traveling from out of state and won't be able to come back, so I want to make sure there's adequate time for questions. First.
At this point, it's still early for me to know if I have any questions, but I thank you so much for coming. Reform is everywhere, and I'm so glad that other states have taken on some of this. Thank you for your... Okay, yes. Yes, I know we're running. We have 5 minutes left, and I was quizzing my... committee to see if we could continue this at 3 or 4, but at this point I'm not sure we can. So I know that Dr. Hedberg from Public Health Division has to leave, and you're nearby, right, Sean?
Yep.
So can we get at least Dr. Hedberg's testimony in, and we may have to carry this on to another day.
Tuesdays.
Okay. Madam Chair, as we look at health care reform, we see those kind of numbers. I've seen them before. It's just stunning. And your knowledge is power. Why insurers or anyone pays that disparity, it's just amazing to me. And why the cost could be that much different is it speaks to the efficiency of the organization that's charging those rates.
That's right.
It's just amazing.
Thank you. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold, but Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thanks very much for allowing me to testify today in support of Senate Bill 453. For the record, I'm Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the interim state epidemiologist with the Oregon Public Health Division. And I think the presentation you just heard showed all a number of the uses that this kind of all-payer database could have for health care and looking at health care utilization and costs, which is clearly a very important aspect, but I want to address a little bit about what such a database might do for public health and for us actually monitoring some of the health status of the population. Public health is about promoting the health of the whole population and preventing disease. Information that we currently get about the public's health status is derived from reportable disease registries, such as our communicable disease registry, and we also have a cancer registry. We get data from vital records like birth certificates, death certificates, and self-reported risk behavior surveys, where we call people on the telephone and ask them about a number of both risk factors, and we also ask about some diseases, like whether or not they've ever been diagnosed with diabetes. And we do analyze hospital discharge data, but those we do not get reported to us by name, so we're not able to deduplicate those. So we do have very good data on certain diseases in Oregon, and certainly what Oregonians are dying of. But we don't have very good data on what's happening, both preventive care visits that are happening in doctor's offices, or other diseases that might be diagnosed and treated at an ambulatory care basis. Nor do we get information about some of the medications, follow-up tests, and the management of chronic diseases such as asthma or diabetes. So just a few examples of how we in public health might be able to use these data. Clearly, it's important for people who are diagnosed with diabetes to be involved in self-management of that disease. Obviously, if diabetes is left unchecked, it can lead to some very severe complications like heart disease, kidney failure, with trips to the emergency department, etc. So a comprehensive insurance claim database would allow us to monitor visits that people have, people who have diabetes have, and see whether or not they're getting the appropriate preventive care at that time, including medications. Asthma is another example that was brought up. Clearly, there's a disparity in asthma both around the state and also by socioeconomic status. And with this kind of insurance claims data, we'd be able to look at some of these variations in asthma across the state and look at which risk factors might be associated with uncontrolled asthma. So those are a couple of examples. Another thing, clearly, we're about preventive care visits, including influenza vaccination, childhood immunizations, and those kinds of things. And again, we do have a childhood immunization registry, but this would allow us to look at, for example, flu vaccine or pneumococcal vaccine among adults, which we now get by survey. So in sum, from the public health perspective, we would support very much this kind of all claims database that we would then be able to analyze by some of the key characteristics that we're interested in, such as age, sex, county of residence, race, ethnicity, to be able to address some health disparities that might be occurring in different populations. So thanks very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all have.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions? Colleagues, I need to know if any of you are available at 3:30. I know Senator Morissette is not. Are you available? What we'd like to do is continue this hearing at 3:30 in Hearing Room A this afternoon, and hopefully we can sum up 3:30. Is that all right?
What'd you say?
3:30 in Hearing Room A.
Okay, I'll try to make it.
I can make it, Madam Chair.
All right. And because it should only take us probably 15 minutes to a half hour to get through the rest of the testimony, so it won't be long, Dr. Bates, but I would like a quorum, and I'm not sure if...
I'll try to make that.
Okay.
3:30 to 4?
Yeah, 3:30 to 4.
Here in
room B. Okay. With that, I'll recess until 3:30 this afternoon in Hearing Room A. Thank you, colleagues.